Welcome to the post-correction phase of the Planetary Tantra Talks. And with the main Turton, John Lash, in mega high gear as we navigate with the Wisdom Goddess, please let this passage from the Nag Hammadi Codices sink deeply into your consciousness. When Pistis saw the impiety of the Lord Archon, she was filled with anger. Acting in her invisible form, she spoke in this way: "You are mistaken, blind one, false deity who cannot see. There is an immortal, luminous child, the Anthropos, who came into existence before you, and who will appear among your mottled forms. This luminous child will trample you in scorn, just as a potter's clay is pounded into a lump. And you will sink away to your proper zone, the abyss of gravity, along with those who belong to your legion. For at the consummation of your work, the entire defect of archontic illusion, exposed in the light of truth, will be abolished, and that illusion will be as if never had been. On the Origin of the World." All right, and I welcome you to Planetary Tantra Talk number 13. This is coming 2 days after Planetary Tantra Talk number 12. And so we are still obviously just coming out of the full moon in the Bhairavi lunar cycle. And I think John and I are both kind of set up personality-wise that we don't do a lot of chit-chat. As a matter of fact, I don't think either one of us have ever engaged in chit-chat at all. So we're just going to jump right into things. And John, I welcome you to the show, and I know you have some things you would like to cover here right at the outset.
Yeah, that's right. Hi, Thomas. Good to be back with you. I'm glad we have a quickened pace here on our interviews, because there's a lot coming down the road here. And I think that our timing is good. Timing is a lot. Timing is really important in Tantra. And it's also important to warriors and lovers. So we're going to keep this timing up as best we can. I have a couple of observations, a couple of points rather. One is an observation and one is an instruction to offer at the beginning of this session. Is this number 13, by the way?
Yes, it is, number 13.
Good. Well, let's see if it's going to be the lucky 13. First observation is, first point of instruction concerns this Bhairavi shift. Now, those of who are listening, many of those who are listening will know about the Dakini shifts and the important role they play in Planetary Tantra, although they may not have followed them. Some others have been following them for some time now. Naturally, since the beginning of summer, you and I have been concentrating a lot on the Gaian Navigation Experiment, which is the way that we participate in Gaia's correction. And in that context, we are looking at the sky, we are looking at the position of Jupiter and the Earth, we're looking at the lunar surges, not necessarily paying attention to the Dakini shifts as such. So it's kind of like a dual vision. A dual practice. And so once in a while, it is very helpful to refer to the Dakini shift. And I just had kind of breakthrough today regarding this Dakini shift of Bhairavi, that I'd like to share with you.
Please.
You know, I was looking back to 2008, and in 8-8-2008 is when I got the term of Gaia Awakening, and during the month of August 2008, some tremendous things happened in my mystical life and in my life as a Turtan. And that was during the Bharavi shift. And then subsequently in 2009 and 2010, when the Bharavi shift came around again, which is generally late July, early August, I couldn't handle it. I couldn't put it together. And it was remarkable to me as a Turtan that I couldn't make any sense of the Bharavi shift for the last 2 years. And of course, in 2008, I didn't even know it was the Bharavi shift. You know, because when I discovered the terma, I hadn't yet formulated the system of Dakini shifts correlated to the new moons, the lunar cycle. I didn't do that until October of 2008. So anyway, to cut to the chase, I've been a bit perplexed and nonplussed and whatever you want to call it, because in my Tertonic responsibilities, I ought to be able to give some direction or some instruction regarding all these Dakini shifts, you know? After all, here I am, I'm making the claim that I can transceive these 16 or 18 different frequencies, which is quite an extravagant claim. I don't ask anybody to believe me, but look at what I deliver from the transception, try it out, see if it's voracious, try it yourself, and that's the way to know if there's any truth in my claims. So up until now, I've lived up to my claims, as it were, you know. I've lived up to my own practice, but not with Bhairavi. And today, this afternoon, in fact, around 1 o'clock, I was walking to the post office in Gaussin, in the company of my companion, Kundri. And I didn't get a Bhairavi instruction, but I got the insight about Bhairavi instruction that I've been missing until now. You see, up until now, if you go into Planetary Tantra and look at what I've written on the lunar Shaktis, I've transcribed Dakini syntax for almost all of the Dakinis and Mahavidyas, haven't I?
Yes, yes. They're basically all there. There are a couple of small gaps.
Right. But there's a big gap when it comes to Bhairavi, who is Simamukha, the lion-headed Dakini, who was the special teacher of Padmasambhava. She is cognate with Sekhmet, and she represents the raging solar energy, the raging energy of the sun. You know, the lion is associated with the sun.
Sure, with the corona and everything, yes.
Right. She also represents the guardianship of warriors, sacred anger, and of course, Bhairavi, whose name means the terrible one, is an aspect of Durga and an aspect of the warrior goddess Kali, who is herself an aspect of the rage and wrath of Sophia. Now, Sophia, the divine Sophia, planetary animal mother, has wrath. She has anger, just like a lioness protecting her pride. So when we come into the Bhairavi shift, we come in some respect into engagement with this wrath of the mother goddess, the wisdom goddess. And I haven't been able to deliver one shred of syntax for Bhairavi. Not one shred. It's sad, isn't it?
Yeah, it is kind of a perplexing situation, isn't it?
It's a revealing omission, if I might say so myself. And today I realized why, and I'll give it to you just as it came to me. The blade of sacred anger is silence. When you look at a samurai blade, just look at it. Take it out of the sheath. Hold it up in front of you. Look at the length of that blade. that's been tempered and pounded 30,000 times, enfolded and pounded, until it's the hardest steel in the world and the sharpest. And when you look at that blade, and when you look and run your eyes along the edge of that blade, there is only silence. Because the blade of sacred anger is silence. I don't say that it is silent. I say it is silence. And what I realized is there's no syntax from Bhairavi. Because all transactions with her occur in ritual and not in language.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I just made a note to myself that about question number 6 I have on the list is something that might hint that I'm kind of picking up on this myself, because that is the subject that I wanted to talk about, was the relation of silence, silent knowing, to the general practice of planetary tantra. So please go ahead and continue with that.
Well, this is my realization of today regarding Bhairavi, and I'm passing it on to you hot off the griddle here. And it is hot here in Spain. It's about 105 degrees. Hot off the griddle. There is no syntax. Why didn't the main Tirtan transceive any Bhairavi syntax in language form? Because that's my skill as a Tirtan. I have the neuronal circuits that I can convert these Dakini frequencies into actual language. Why didn't I produce any? Because she doesn't transmit in language. All transactions with Bhairavi are done ritually and non-verbally.
So by ritually and non-verbally, you mean through the act of a ritual that the practitioner would perform, that the communication would come through in a non-verbal, say, energetic kind of a transmission.
Non-verbal, energetic, and intentional communication without words is done by ritual. So, for instance, one way, if you wanted to communicate something to Bhairavi, and this is both ways, and I also have the message. It's not sort of a message, but it's sort of a Tirtan's intuition. I'll give you my inspired guess. I would say that the communication two-way with this Dakini, with this Mahavidya, is extremely intense. In general practice with the Shakti cluster, we are currently in mostly a receiving mode. We're in a receiving mode to the Dakini frequencies because Sophia released the Terma of Gaia Awakening in August 2008 to confer to you, the human species, her instructions for interaction with her. That is precisely and exactly the purpose of this Terma. She herself, awakening in her lucid dream, provides the instructions, the sacred instructions, for how to become interactive with her. And most of that interactivity in the beginning, in these early years, is going to be one way, us receiving from the Dakinis. I'm getting the feeling that the interactivity with Bhairavi is two-way and very intense. So, for instance, here's an experiment. If you wanted to communicate something to Bhairavi, who represents the force of sacred anger, if you wanted to invoke her force, which is highly protective and which is a devouring and destructive fire against predators, you could formulate a message or intention that you wanted to send to Bhairavi. And then formulate it in your mind into a clear language. Say you make a sentence. Just one sentence would be enough. You could even write down the sentence. In fact, that would be a good idea. Write down one clear sentence. And by the way, never plead. You never plead or pray to Dakinis. They don't respond to that. You ask them as one equal to another. You ask them for intervention. You can ask them for intervention, but never plead and never do it in a begging or obsequious tone.
So don't come on your knees to them.
Absolutely not. Don't come in any subservient or inferior way, because they will disregard you. So bring your warrior heart, your warrior courage to them Offer your innocence to Kali at the beginning of any ritual that you do with the Shakti cluster. That is the only offering that Kali accepts. That's all she wants, and that's all she needs. She wants the offering of your innocence. Then maybe write a sentence asking Bhairavi to intervene in some situation in your life that's out of your control, where you're angry, or where something is bothering you. And then write it down. And then sit down on the ground with that piece of paper in front of you and sign it to her as you, if you were talking to a deaf person.
Oh, I see that sign. Okay.
Yeah, sign it. Put it into sign language and use your hands to form the intention that you've written down, but don't say it verbally, and transmit it to her in mudra or gesture, because that is a ritual. That would be a way, and this is just the beginning. I can think of a number of new approaches here. This is starting to open up a whole new facet for me, just as I'm speaking to you. But that would be one way. In fact, I started signing to Gaia when I was on Infinity Ridge. Because when I first got her attention in 2002, I realized that I didn't know how to handle it, and I didn't know how to hold her attention. But I had it. I was certain of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't speak to her aloud. I didn't stand there up on the ridge and say things aloud to her. But I guess I intuitively understood that gesture and body language is more powerful in some instances than verbal language. Or I should say more appropriate. So I've had conversations with Gaia on Infinity Ridge in where I completely signed it to her. Making it up as I went along, you know, putting the
spontaneous mudras and gestures and body positions.
Totally. Yeah. So this is my current breakthrough insight today on Bhairavi. Very happy that you're there. And for those of you who are listening, thank you for your attention, because this kind of sacred instruction belongs to this moment right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great pleasure and privilege for me to be able to share it, to be able to put it out there.
Well, thank you, John. Thank you very much. And so that is the observation you had. Now, you said you had an instruction as well.
That was my instruction.
Is that the instruction?
That's the instruction. That's the instruction about Bhairavi communication. Now here comes my observation, and I think here we might pick up onto some of your questions.
Okay.
You know, we've been hearing for months and months and months, if not years, about these massive solar flares. And if you go on the internet and you watch the people who monitor them, it's just the same thing over and over again. I mean, it's the same. It's terribly monotonous. I don't watch them anymore, you know? It's been going on for months now. A significant solar flare in the region of number 112436, and we expect significant effects on Earth. Oh, do we? Well, excuse me, but could you tell me what the fuck kind of effects I can expect, please?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, nobody says anything about that I've heard.
The only thing that's true.
Heard, and I'm sure everyone who's listening to me right now has heard the same thing. Oh, wait a minute. We're wired to the Earth. We're wired to Gaia electromagnetically. The solar emissions impact the electromagnetic field of the Earth and our brains. And there's some kind of interactivity between the human brain, which is an electrical neuronal circuitry, and the surrounding electromagnetic field. And so these massive solar emissions are going to be impacting our bodies and impacting the bioelectrical magnetic circuits of the human organism. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
People have written long articles on this in Reality Sandwich. Okay? The question is, how? How are they going to affect it? You know, and how are we going to deal with it? Well, I'd like to offer now my observations, perfectly subjective and personal observations, I may be detecting in my own life and in my own body the impact of these massive solar emissions. And I'd like to tell you what I'm experiencing, and you can compare it to your own lives and draw your own conclusions. Okay?
Please.
I have this confirmed, by the way, by one person who is going through the same thing at the same time. So I'm not entirely alone. And she concurs totally in these observations. I found myself about 6 weeks ago slipping into a very unusual kind of lassitude, a fatigue, a lassitude. And I thought maybe it might have been due to the fact that Spanish summer is coming on and it gets really, really hot here. And I don't like the heat. In fact, I didn't stay down here in southern Spain for quite a few years. I went up north to Belgium because I didn't want to be in the August heat. I thought, well, I'm going to be here this year. The heat's coming on. At first, I thought it was kind of like a heat exhaustion. And it is like a heat exhaustion that I'm feeling. But it has a number of other characteristics. This is the most concise way I can describe them. And you just take it on board and see if you feel anything similar. I feel this deep fatigue, but it's not like being tired. It's more like a moral fatigue. It's like the circuit between intention and doing is very weak. So I might intend to do something, but the motivation or the morale that would then bring me to do what I intend to do is very, very weak. It's not entirely missing, but it's weak. It's like there's a very weak signal running from intention to action. Consequently, there's a sense of being inactive and listless, and a sense of a kind of fatigue, but it's not like any kind of fatigue I've ever experienced before in my life. I have lived in LA in a very hot summer. I've experienced 120 degree weather at 10 o'clock in the morning in Madras, Spain. In Madras, India, I've experienced heat exhaustion. And this is sort of like heat exhaustion, but it's much deeper. It seems to be actually impacting my nervous system and making it very difficult for me to concentrate on anything or to follow through from intention to action. The second quality about it, and this is really key, I've been discussing this a lot with Kundry, is that there's inside this feeling of listlessness and exhaustion, there is a tension. There's a tension inside it, and there's an irritability. There's an anger and an irritability. There's a raw, tense feeling inside it. So it's kind of paradoxical. At the same time that I'm feeling, going through the course of the day, listless, aimless, not sleepy, not tired, but with diminished vitality, perhaps. At the same time that I'm feeling that, I'm feeling this edge, this tension, this anger inside. There's something ready to explode from this passive condition. So those are my observations, and I wonder if they have something to do with the actual way that these massive coronal emissions are working their way into us, working their way into our minds and bodies. So I offer that for what it's worth.
Yeah, well, that was the first comment I made to you in our very brief little pre-talk chat there. As I did, I mentioned I've been feeling a bit of fatigue, or actually quite a heavy bit of fatigue the past few weeks, actually. And I've even commented on that to my family, that I haven't felt this kind of a fatigue since, say, 10 years ago when I was racing road bikes all over Japan in competitions. So, yeah, there is something going on. And I guess if you're feeling that, and I'm feeling that, and I've been hearing that from other people as well, yes, it would be interesting to trace down what the cause of that is.
Yeah, let's keep our eyes open. I encourage those crew members of the Gaia Navigation Experiment who are listening to this to write me with their observations about it at Navigator. And anyone else who's listening in, write me at jll@medhistory.org to share your observations if you're feeling anything similar to this. And I have to tell you, I was having a conversation last night in the cool of the evening, we'd crawl out on the terrace here and lay around like dogs, you know. And I was laying out there with Kundry, and we were saying, you know, what if this is actually what's happening? If this is actually how it is affecting us, one of the first identifiable symptoms, can you imagine what would happen if this continues for years? I mean, people would be dropping like flies. People would be driving down the freeway. They'll pass out in their cars.
Mm-hmm.
Masses of people walking around in the cities, in the main streets, will just drop. I mean, you know, I'm very lucky because I don't have a job and I don't have to report to anyone. I don't have to meet any schedule. So I can sit back here at my leisure and assess this, assess the effect that I'm feeling. But just imagine the people who can't, you know, they're going to have to be in denial. They're going to have to, like, when they get up in the morning and they're feeling this, they're going to have to override it in order to get to work or take care of their kids and so forth and so on. But suppose that it continues and becomes more intense. What are we going to be looking at here, folks?
Indeed, yeah. The word you said was drop off. You could see a lot of people just kind of giving up the spirit there and losing their lives in ways that, for example, car accidents and things like that as well.
Right.
Yeah,
not being able to go to work.
In that,
you know,
kind of bizarre sense.
Exactly. And look in the news. Those of you who watch the mainstream news, watch the mainstream news or check Google for heat exhaustion, because that's the first thing they're going to say about it.
Mm-hmm.
Unusual cases of heat exhaustion were recorded in Seattle this weekend. You know, this is how it's going to start to come out. So this could be the direction we're going in. But anyway, those are my observations of what I'm feeling, because I've been very perplexed and frankly exasperated about hearing all this stuff about coronal emissions and not being able to, like, bring it down to earth and make any sense about how it is actually affecting us here and now. And I think here, I strongly sense that this is voracious and that this can be tested and verified.
Very interesting. Okay, let's keep our eyes out for that and kind of collect any kind of empirical evidence we have in the sense of stories and actual experiences from people on the crew.
Let's do.
All right. Well, John, let's go ahead and pick up from where we were last time. We finished talking about wanting to go a little bit deeper into how to deal with the archontic stare. I know we've dealt with this now two times.
Right.
You said you had a couple other things you wanted to add to that.
Sure.
In the last talk, you talked about using the tantric Gayan vow when you prick your finger and share blood with Gaia Sophia as one way to bind with the earth and then to alleviate, I guess, in a sense, the archontic stare. Now, you said you had some other things you'd like to add to that. Would you like to pick up on that?
Yeah, I have two other things. But first, I want to say that somewhere a while back, I came across someone discussing me on the internet. It was on some site where they had, it was some kind of like New Age yoga, and they were talking about human residence and resonance. And they made the comment, well, Lash is really wrong about one thing. He's wrong about Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga is the age of iron. Iron is what binds us and pulls us down and binds us into the electromagnetic field of the earth. And since it is assumed, or at least it was assumed by the person who wrote this site, that being bound into the electromagnetic state of the earth was a state somehow of degeneration or captivity, which is absolutely wrong, absolutely wrong, you know, he said, Lash has got it completely wrong. We shouldn't make a pact with these Dakini forces, and we shouldn't try to bind ourselves into the electromagnetic field of the earth. We should, like, ascend. We should, like, raise our kundalini frequency so that we float above these crude and these degenerate electromagnetic currents of Kali Yuga. So, that's a fucking laugh. I'm here to tell you, my friends, that these crude and degenerate currents of the earth are this only salvation that we have, if you want to think of salvation. And the watchword for spiritual practice in Kali Yuga is not ascension. Anybody who's using that word is conning you and leading you down a luciferic path to some pie-in-the-sky solution. Now, I don't care if they're using the name Sophia or they're using the name of Mae West. It's the same con.
You had mentioned that in the last talk, and that was, I have it right here on my notes, that had a huge impact on me, that ascension is going the exact opposite direction we want to go.
Yeah.
We want to go deeper. We want to go into more enmeshing with the currents, the actual bowels of the earth, so to speak.
Binding into the earth in deep engagement with the telluric currents of the wisdom goddess is the only way that we're going to survive. And therefore, I propose the word immersion. Immersion is the operative term in the syntax of planetary tantra. Seek immersion. Practice immersion. Do not go the path of ascension or anyone who presents you with a package of metaphysical make-believe teachings about ascension. So immersion can be enhanced in a number of ways. The first way is to prick your thumb. You don't have to bleed into the earth. This isn't an Aztec ritual. One drop will do. Bleed, prick your thumb as you do the Gayan Tantric vow. Now, there are a couple of other ways that I would suggest that we could deal with this remote viewing stare to the back of the neck. Remember, I use the analogy of a pool. If you're in a pool and someone's trying to drown you by pushing you down, holding you underwater, the way you get out of their grip is you go deeper into the water. And it's the same principle here. So if you go out in a nice place in nature and sit maybe with your back up against a tree and sit on a log or something that raises your butt so it's a little bit higher than the ground, put your bare feet in front of you on the ground, but not directly in front of you. Stretch them out a little and separate them to about a foot and a half apart. So there you are, sitting there comfortably, your knees are up, and your bare feet are on the earth. Then take the palms of your hands and press the palms of your hands down on either side of you so that they also touch the earth. For instance, if you were doing this against a tree trunk, which would be a very good idea, put your spine against the tree trunk, and you were sitting on a small cushion, you would kind of slump back against the tree trunk, and you would come down on your palms, but you would have your palms and the bare soles of your feet and the earth together. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Just take that position. It's very comfortable, very slouched out, you know. There's a slouched out person playing, practicing planetary tantra, sitting over there against that tree, right?
Mm-hmm.
Simple. Do that for a while until you feel a certain something. I don't know what. You just feel, you feel impelled to move. You feel maybe a shift in the energy, or you feel impelled to move. Then what you do is you take your hands, palms off the earth, and you lean forward, and you put your head down between your knees. Just let it drop. Keep your feet in the same position in the earth. Take your two hands and lace the fingers together and put them behind your neck. And then you can kind of rest your elbows on your knees, and your head is sort of hanging down there, and your feet are still in the same position in the earth. Can you visualize that?
Yes, I've got that.
That's the second part of the posture. And what you're doing in the first part of the posture is you're grounding yourself and discharging and grounding at the same time in the earth through both your hands and your feet, palms and soles. Very powerful. And then when you bring your hands together, weave your fingers together and put them behind your neck, then you are actually closing that circuit that you have created. You've gone deeper into the telluric force field of the earth, and now you want to close that circuit. You want to hold yourself at that depth of immersion, and you do that by the second part of the exercise. Just let your head hang down naturally. Don't have to strain the body. This is nothing. There's no strain involved anywhere in this exercise. Just kind of let your head hang down and bring your hands on that back part of your neck, which is where the Archon stare is directed. and just hold that as long as it feels comfortable. And generally what you'll feel after a while, it could be 2 or 3 minutes, it could be as long as 10 minutes, depends the energy. The way that which each of us processes these things is very idiosyncratic. But what you feel is a kind of release. You feel a kind of like that. And then you'll know that the energy has been gathered and held as it should be. So that's one thing you can do. And there's a way that you can even test if this is working, if this is actually grounding you.
A way to test it. Okay.
Yeah. When you get up and you walk away, keep it staying in your bare feet if you can. And as you walk away, put your two palms in front of you at chest level and rub them together. Rub your palms against each other, okay? The fingers of your hand are pointing out from your chest, and you're just very softly rubbing your palms together. And then hold up your palms and look at them very carefully. And this may not happen the first time you do this, and it also depends on places that you do it. Like if you do it over a place where there's an aquifer, or if you do it by a waterfall, or around a spring, and in certain places like sacred sites and megalithic sites, you will get this effect more rapidly. You will notice that your palms are modeled.
Modeled? How do you mean that?
They are like, instead of being like a uniform color of flesh, that you see red mottling.
Oh, mottled. Okay, yeah, I got it. Got you.
Yeah, M-O-T-T. Yes. Your palms are mottled. In other words, you will see that your palms are white, but that they have red blotches on them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look closely, you'll see that the mottling has a pattern, and that the red blotches are actually, it's like capillaries. They're organized in lines.
Mm-hmm.
So the blotching can be random, and that's a fairly good result of immersion. But when the blotching, when the mottled sections, the red sections, are aligned in lines like capillaries, you've got really good deep immersion. And that is because what you're actually seeing is that the iron magnetism content of the hemoglobin of your blood has lined itself up.
Kind of like the filings in affected by a magnet.
Exactly. Exactly.
Hmm.
And you know, there's a very interesting... I'm going to be doing something on crop circles soon, by the way, coming up at the end of this month. And among the documentaries on crop circles on YouTube, there is a very good one done in 2006 by a Norwegian or Swedish documentary person. Sorry, I can't give you the exact name of it, but it's we'll link it. Maybe I'll send you the URL, Thomas, and you can link it to this interview.
Okay.
About halfway through this documentary on crop circles, the commentator, who is also the director, points to a very interesting phenomenon. He points out that in crop circles that are genuine, these microscopic iron-charged globules are found.
Mm-hmm.
Microscopic iron-charged spheres are found in crop circles. Now, it's the most remarkable fact that these are also the spheres that were found in the dust in 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've heard that, and I've heard that from Dr. Wood herself, yeah.
Dr. Judy Wood, who wrote Where Did the Towers Go?, points out in page 333 of her book that the same kind of microspheres of iron that were found massively in the dust of 9/11 are also found in crop circles. Now, what does that mean? Well, as far as I can tell, you have to pay attention to what Dr. Judy Wood is saying, which no one else is saying, and which scares the living shit out of a lot of people. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, the truth can be very outrageous, can it?
Mm-hmm.
And what Dr. Wood is saying, on the weight of the evidence in her book, is that A, the iron charged particles found in the dust are not evidence of the use of thermite, necessarily. They would appear in any situation where steel and aluminum were pulverized. They are a natural byproduct of the massive molecular pulverization of steel and aluminum. And since the towers did not fall, but they were pulverized into dust, up to 90% of their material, it's not surprising that we find these particles, and they are not proof of the thermite theory, which is a deception of the controlled opposition of the 9/11 truth movement, okay?
That's right, that's right.
So the second point, that's the ugly truth. Now let's get to the beautiful truth. The beautiful truth is that the same directed energy physics that was used as a horrific weapon of terror at 9/11 is also used to make crop circles. It's the same technology. It's the same physics, and that's why it leaves the same signature. And there's a remarkable moment in this documentary, this crop circle documentary, where there's actually filming this woman's hands. And she's saying, "My God, look what happened to me. I was in this crop circle, and as I was standing in there and walking around, I'm looking at my hands, and suddenly my hands became all mottled, and they had all these red lines in them." And then she said, "I was scared, and I didn't know what it was." And then she said, "But then I noticed something," and the documentary, the filmmaker actually filmed this. They went back into the circle with her. She held out her two hands, palms up. And as she lowered her hands, the mottling appeared on her hands. And as she raised her hands, the mottling became less visible.
Hmm.
So she was in a crop circle, which is an area of the Earth that has been charged by directed energy in such a way that the telluric forces of the electromagnetism of the Earth have been unnaturally excited. And in that circle, just by moving in that circle, it aligned the molecules of iron in the hemoglobin of her blood, the proof being that you could see it in the palm of her hands. And you can see this in your hands, too. If you go out and you do these practices and you reach a certain level of immersion, you will see this mottling in the palm of your hands as actual evidence that you are binding into the iron-rich field of the Earth. And that is a key, key practice in planetary tantra.
That's very interesting. I'm very amazed that you were able to kind of bring those two points together and connect them into planetary tantra. That's a very interesting insight.
Well, the revelation, the breakthrough about free energy and directed energy is going to be woven into the message of planetary tantra, is being woven into the message of planetary tantra as we speak.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I can see where you're going with it. And it's the promise, and it's also the, what would you call it, the final blow, in a sense, the worst case scenario. They're both contained in free energy.
They are. It's the deal breaker. I call it the deal breaker. It's the deal breaker for our species. And nobody but Judy Wood has got to the truth of it, Dr. Judy Wood, in her analysis, because she doesn't speculate. She doesn't go off on wild conspiracy theories. She doesn't say anything about who did it. She just says what it was done with. She shows what it was done with. The evidence, and especially the anomalies of things that are completely inexplicable that occurred at that site, completely inexplicable in terms of modern physics that we know. All of these anomalies and all the evidence that she gathers points to the use of directed energy weapons. And so that means that there are people on this earth right now, living and breathing, as you and I talk, who have in their possession these devices and are using them against humanity. And if that isn't the worst case scenario of our species, I'd ask you to cook up a worse one.
Yeah, if that doesn't get you fired up and get you invigorated to figure out what the hell is going on and how to take care of it and how to fight this situation, then you really, there's nothing else that's going to ever get you to be interested in this.
It's the focus. The 9/11 is like the sights. Those two towers are like the sights on a rifle. You know, those two towers, look right through those sights and you will see the two possible futures. And the good news is that the way 9/11 was done, the proof of how it was done, which Dr. Judy Wood alone has provided, shows that we have directed energy technology and that the benevolent uses of it in every aspect of society are possible right now. And so it's the responsibility of every human being to realize that and to claim and demand that those resources and that technology and science be available to us as a global society and make that an absolute priority. That's where we focus. That's the fantastic thing about 9/11. It's the place where we can all come together and we can all focus on solution.
Yeah, I'm in total agreement with you there, and I have a tentative go-ahead from you and from Dr. Wood to do a three-person talk here on this in the future sometime when things work out for us to do it.
Oh, is that so? Because I hadn't thought of that. You mean Dr. Wood and myself and you?
That's right.
Well, excellent, Thomas. I'm up for that.
Okay, great. Well, great, John. Well, let's move into some other things here. Let's see. I'm going back to kind of some of the notes that you had sent me a couple of weeks ago, and I want to kind of go with one of the questions that you posed to me to pose to you in a sense, and that is you talk about the current breakthrough, and I think you're referring to Planetary Tantra itself. You say that you're getting three kinds of responses, or there's three kinds of responses to Planetary Tantra. One is that people respond to it and they handle it and they master it. Some people respond to it and are unable to master it. And some people choose, I would say, to remain in oblivion. And you talk about how you want to optimize those first two steps and to offer teaching on how to handle these powers. And then you put a note here at the end, this deals with deep negotiations of fate. And I was wondering how you'd like to proceed with that. If that's not too far back to stir it up in your memory there.
Yeah. Well, I have to ask you when you're, Thomas, and this is just a personal question, but when you're eating a cow, do you like, do you bite off the complete haunch and chew it, or do you cut it up in pieces first?
definitely cut it up into pieces.
Well, we have to cut this up into a few pieces because it's like you've bitten off the haunch of the bull here, you know, and there's so many essential questions contained in this in the things that you just said.
Yes, it's a biggie.
Yeah. I would put it in this way. Let's consider how Planetary Tantra is going to proceed from this point on, you know, how it might unfold in the optimal way. Well, in the first place, one of the beautiful things about Planetary Tantra is you don't negotiate a marriage with it. You just jump in the sack, you know. And that's the only way that you get onto it. I've had a few people, not very many, but I've a few people come to me kind of saying, you know, wheedling and saying, well, this and well, that, and, you know, how does it work? And what about this? And I don't even bother to get into that because the people like yourself who have become engaged with Planetary Tantra are seized by it immediately, you know. It's like the line in that song, from Leonard Cohen in that wonderful album he did, The Future, you know, I am not the one who loves, you know, it's love that seizes me. So this is the way it works, you know, and this is the way it's going to work with, is now working with greater and greater intensity as PT goes fractal. More and more people just getting seized by the beauty and intensity and immediacy of what this is and by the absolute simplicity of it. Now, I don't like to repeat myself, but I can't emphasize too much that the Terma of Gaia Awakening, which is the vehicle of sacred instruction for Planetary Tantra, has three lines. It just has three lines. And,
yes,
you know, go look at those lines, you know, go look at them on Planetary Tantra and look at them closely, my friends. You think you may have had spiritual practices in the past. Maybe you did transcendental meditation, or you did 20 years of the Gurdjieff work, or you did the Sufi work, or you did this kind of yoga and that kind of yoga, or you're in Tibetan Buddhism and you're doing Vajrayana, 108,000 Vajrayana prayers and all that, you know. 108,000 Vajrayana prayers is easier than the practice of the first instruction, which is you cannot
become nothing but more beautiful.
You cannot become anything but more beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier than that. That is one of the most rigorous instructions that you will ever have. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it is so hard that you can't do it. It's so simple that you can't miss it.
You can't not do it.
You can't not do it, but you've got to stay with it. You've got to realize how powerful it is. And likewise, for the second instruction, love.
Yes, that love and the supernatural operate at the same frequency.
Love and the supernatural operate on the same frequencies. Now, that is a teaching that you can spend the rest of your life every day practicing, and it will reward you, hate to use the word reward, it will reward you with true and verifiable results. This is not metaphysics and make-believe I'm talking about here. This is the sacred instruction on interactivity with the earth that comes from the earth. That's why nobody can beat it, you know. Nobody can beat and nobody can compete with planetary tantra. Excuse me for being the one to say so. And it's not because it comes from John Lash and he is, you know, the Superman. Not in the least. It's because of the nature of what it is. And so what I find now, and it opens my heart tremendously and gives me huge courage and encouragement, is that people are getting it. People are getting it. It's never going to be a quantitative thing. It's intensive. It's not extensive. It's qualitative practice. It's not quantitative practice. So it's not a matter of 30 million people in the world doing planetary tantra. It's a homeopathic remedy for human insanity. And the cure is in the dose.
It's in the dose and it's in the quality.
That's right. And what's coming up now, next month, is going to be more practice and more, I should say, I don't like to speak in the future tense. I have to be very careful what I say. Kali breathing down my neck. What I am currently doing is preparing the syntax and the framework to teach Gaian ethics. And when I can teach Gaian ethics, this is a matter of total fucking astonishment. Total astonishment. What is Gaian ethics? Gaian ethics is the way to behave on this earth toward each other and the way to behave toward predators, interspecies predators, that has never, ever been formulated before as an ethical standard until now. And it becomes possible by receiving direct instruction from Kali Ma and from Vivi herself to formulate Gaian ethics. And within this framework of Gaian ethics comes the practice of Gaian eco-sorcery, which includes lethal kill on predators. And this is coming fast. This is right around the bend. And it's the next phase of planetary tantra. So the next phase, we will continue with these delightful talks, and we will always continue with the instruction and the inspiration that thrives and throbs in this terma. But more and more, we continue with actual instruction, actual practice, actual ritual activity. So I think it's very appropriate that I had this realization just now before the talk, and I've been able to get it out here while it's hot and steamy.
Wonderful. So we're going to see more of a direction in ritual and in practice and in Gaian ethics.
That's right.
That's wonderful. And I'm sure there's quite a few predators out there that are, their tails are kind of being pulled in between their legs right now.
I don't think
they know they have nothing to, there's no way they can defend themselves against that.
There's no way to defend yourself when you can't see it coming. And they can't see it coming. You could announce to them it was coming and they wouldn't believe it because they're so stupid and arrogant. And their great illusion is that they think that they are beyond reach. And I intend to show that they are certainly not beyond reach.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah. Yeah, that's coming fairly soon as well.
Next month.
Next month. Very good. Very good. So sometime in September, huh?
Indeed.
Fantastic. Well, I'm ready for it.
Yeah, you've been ready for it since you were like 3 years old, man.
That is true. How did you know that?
Just a wild guess.
Yeah, and I got a real good boost of it, of excitement about 4 months ago. So I've been waiting patiently and not so patiently at times. So it's good to know it's coming in September.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yes.
And who is the Dakini in September?
Well, you know, this is a really suspenseful moment. I've been scrutinizing the charts in the skies like a maniac. That is to say, someone from Maine. It's possible. Oh, God. It gives me goosebumps to say this, but it's possible that we could have two Bhairavi sequences in a row.
Huh.
It's right now, it's touch and go. But it will either be at the beginning of September, we either click into a second Bhairavi shift, or we click into Sundari or Shodashi, which is the
okay.
Virgin, you know. The new moon,
yes,
coming up, that is the omen of the next shift, falls very close on the border of the lion and the virgin, and it's not possible to call in advance. As you know, so many things that happen in planetary tantra and in the practices that we're doing on Gaia navigation happen in real time. They can't be predicted. You have to show up and observe. And so I can't really say, but it's a very close call.
Hmm.
If we have a second Bhairavi shift,
All bets are off then.
All bets are off, my friend. All bets.
Interesting. Very interesting. Well, let's see, John. Let's go on to, we don't have much more time, so I would like to ask you this question with Carlos Castaneda and Don Juan and Don Gennaro being the warm-up for Planetary Tantra. And how we talked about last time, how the archons cannot see. They're blind. They don't see us in the way that we see living organisms. I was wondering, flipping it the other way around, how does VV see us? Does she see us as luminous beings? Or in what, how does she, I don't want to say visibly, but how does she perceive us?
She perceives us rather in the way that Carlos Castaneda advised, that we should see the great emanations at large. He spoke often of great bands of emanations,
mm-hmm,
and that compose the universe. And he went elaborately into the structure of these bands. He explained that there are inorganic and organic bands, that they have different colors. I must say, over the many years of 30, 35 years of following Castaneda, I found that the better part of those statements that he made hold up very well, and they are verifiable in shamanic practice. So anyway, you know what glass noodles are? You know, you're in Noodleville, mm-hmm, you should know. The Japanese love them.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yep.
There are different kinds of noodles, aren't there? There are flat ones and there are thinner ones.
Mm-hmm.
Do they eat glass noodles?
Yes, it's called bifun. It comes from China.
Right,
yes,
the Chinese are big on these very fine glass noodles. Mm-hmm. So these bands of emanations that Castaneda described are sort of like electrified glass noodles. And I haven't seen them, I have to tell you, and neither has anybody else that I know. It's curious. The structures of energy that Carlos described seem to be valid, but as far as an actual shamanic, perception, heightened perception of these emanations, I haven't seen as such in that way. But it's an energetic concept. It's a concept, and it's a helpful one. And it's helpful in answering your question. the way that she sees us, up to a certain degree of intimacy. I can't tell. Don't know how intimate we can be with her, you know, but up to a certain degree, she only sees us like fleeting streamings, like electrified lines, electrified, glassy, electrified lines cutting through the electromagnetic field of the Earth. She actually sees us in her electromagnetic body as constituent elements of her body. So when she looks at her own electromagnetic body, which is the ambient terrestrial aura of the Earth, the terrestrial aura, she sees these streamings. And what she sees is basically two kinds of streamings. One is she sees scribbles. She sees like little blips and little scribbles, as if they are like little signatures of electrical discharges, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
they run through her electromagnetic field, which is now very chaotic, but used to be much more uniform. It used to be more like the combed pelt of an animal or of a cat. It used to be very uniform. Now it's more like the coat of a cat when a cat's very excited and its fur is ruffled, okay?
So are you putting that distinction there at the time of correction at March 19, or is this a different...
It's been becoming ruffled since she's been waking up, and it's getting intensely ruffled.
Okay.
You know, the electromagnetic field is becoming terribly unstable. But even in mm-hmm. this ruffled field, she can detect certain streams of energy, certain things which are like scribbles, as if you would make a scribble on a piece of paper. And that is how she perceives us. But she also perceives the luminous emanations. She also perceives the presence of the luminous bodies of sorcerers. And those she perceives entirely differently. They don't appear to be scribbles or blips in her electromagnetic field. They appear to be different impressions which actually give her an extraordinary pleasure, almost you could say an erotic pleasure to behold. The goal of a sorcerer in Gaian Echo Sorcery, the goal of a deep practitioner of Planetary Tantra is to form your energy body into a rifling. It's like a rifling. Now, if you look down the barrel of a rifle, you find that it's grooved, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you've ever done that. But the barrel of a rifle...
Oh, of course, yeah. Growing up in Montana,
yeah
absolutely.
Yeah, the barrel of a rifle is grooved, and the groove is a spiral. And why is that? Because the rifling of the barrel spirals the bullet.
Mm-hmm.
It makes the bullet come out of the barrel spinning. Therefore, mm-hmm. it gives the bullet a more sure trajectory because a spinning bullet has more fixed direction.
Mm-hmm.
It gives it more force when it hits because it's spinning. What Gaia loves, what she loves to see, is the rifling lines of sorcerers playing through her electromagnetic body. You bring your energy into a rifling line by your intention and by the force of your intention and your desire. And you do not appear in the way that an ordinary person appears. You do not have a mere squiggle or a little blip of a line. You have a continuous rifling that goes in and out, up and down, through the fabric and the mesh of her electromagnetic body. And she loves the feel of these riflings. She loves it. And because there is a rifling, there is memory of a particular being. The rifling, she reads it as a signature of the individual whose energy is expressed in that rifling, in that swirling helice. It's H-E-L-I-C-E. It's a helice current. Your intention is a helice current, and she reads you by your intention. If you have no intention, she doesn't read you. You're just another random electromagnetic discharge in a chaotic field.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're in a sense drawing her attention to you through your intention, through this rifling.
You draw her attention to you through your intention, which you do ritually and which you do by communicating with her, but in an actual dynamic sense, in the sense of physics and terrestrial physics, you literally do that. You literally draw her attention to you, to you, and you hold it by the force and the precision of the rifling lines of your own personal energy.
That's fascinating. I've experienced that on a few occasions. Of course, the main one was when I did the first Gayan Tantra vow. There was a definite, palpable feeling that she was looking right at me, connected right into my energy field there for quite some time. And it's happened a few times after that as well. So I can totally relate to what you're saying right now.
Well, you know, Thomas, you come from a tradition of the martial arts of the East. And one way that I would characterize that tradition, we just have 2 minutes going here left, is that the tradition of the martial arts of the East was instinctively or mystically cognizant of these lines of rifling, but it didn't go nearly as far as we can go now. It more or less set up the rifling lines and the practices of the martial arts and Bagua and things like that, maintained and set up these rifling lines, but not necessarily in the context of her total energy field or in the context of the acts of magnificent magic and intention that we can now achieve with her. So all of the martial arts are a tremendous background in practice for planetary tantra, but in planetary tantra you even go further with the energetic systems that are implicit in the martial arts, in Tai Chi, Bagua, and so forth.
Yeah, you know, well, that's something that we've talked about before privately is, you know, this planetary tantra is a huge arena where martial arts could flower into a totally different level, a totally different dimension. You know, it's the background that it could flower into a totally different new being.
Totally.
New practice.
Totally. It would come of age in an entirely new way with planetary tantra as a framework. Absolutely.
Wow, that's fascinating, John. That just really, as usual, has my interest extremely piqued there. Very interesting. So rifling, in a sense, is a part of being a telestis.
It is, which it
not in
before.
A sense, it is
the
key part.
It's the new part. It's the telestis of the future, because the telestai of the pagan world didn't have that. Consequently, they weren't able to defend themselves against the predators.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. They wouldn't have been wiped out if they had.
No, they wouldn't have. That's right. So we're at 1 minute and 5 and counting. So 1 hour and 6 minutes is
one
about
hour.
All we can
yeah.
do. So we'll
that's
do it
right.
the next time then.
Okay. Yes, let's do it. I will have to wait a couple days until probably about next Monday or so. But yeah, let's pick it up there. And as usual, I've got tons of pages of notes. So a lot more to talk about.
So did you say next Friday, the 19th?
Actually, it'd be Monday.
Oh, Monday, the 22nd.
Yeah, the 22nd.
All right.
Is that okay with you?
Excellent. I look forward to it. Thank you, as always, and
thank
everyone for listening. Thanks to you all.
All right. Thank you, John. Enjoy the rest of your day there in the heat.
Sayonara.
Sayonara.